Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Well, I'm recording this from a campground in Needles, California. We're on day 8 of the Tour de Peace. It's been fabulous so far. Today I rode 50 miles through the desert. I'm feeling fabulous. We've been able to connect with a lot of awesome people in a lot of awesome places. I invite you to go to tourdepeace.org, TOURDEPEACE.org, for more information about our tour. Well, I recorded my interview with Tina Foster last week while we were on the road. I believe I was in Palm Springs when I recorded it. So anyway, stay tuned, and I'll be back with Tina Foster. My guest today on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is Tina Foster. Tina is now the attorney for Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was wrongly convicted and persecuted. She's a citizen of Pakistan, and it's a fascinating story, and we need to give more airtime and more exposure to this story.
Tina Foster, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I already introduced you as an attorney for Dr. Afia Siddiqui, and I have followed the case pretty closely, but I was hoping that you could talk about what happened, why she was arrested, and then her, what we would probably call a total miscarriage of justice. That's what I would call it, and most people who pay attention and know about justice would call it a miscarriage of justice.
Sure, yeah. And hopefully your listeners have already some background of the case, but I'd like to just, sort of highlight, as part of what a miscarriage of justice this is, and we're talking about somebody, Afia Siddiqui, who is just, a brilliant young mind, had achieved a lot. She was born in Pakistan, but she grew up in Pakistan, but was educated in the United States. She had a doctorate in neuroscience. She was studying children's development, and she was, I think would have gone on to do great things. But unfortunately, she is a common story amongst many women, unfortunately, had an abusive husband who I think is probably likely the source of a lot of what ultimately transpired and ended up in this miscarriage of justice. She was married off in arranged marriage while she was still receiving her education in the United States. She had a couple of children. After September 11th, her husband was questioned by the FBI while they were still in the United States, and they also received a lot of, a lot of harassment in those months after 9/11, and they decided to go back to Pakistan, the marriage was really deteriorating, and as I said, he was an abusive husband, and they eventually divorced in late 2002 or early 2003, and the ex-husband immediately remarried, and then the next thing you know, Dr. Afia and her three children disappeared off the streets of Karachi in March of 2003, and they were on their way to the airport, we believe, to go visit a relative, and then they were, from what we know from witness accounts and investigation, they were, driven off the side of the road, and both English-speaking and Urdu-speaking people ripped both Dr. Afia from the car as well as her three children and put her, essentially separated the children from her and the children from each other. And all of the parties that were in that car on that day ended up in separate secret prisons, and no one resurfaced for 5 years. you know, there's a lot of information out there about how Dr. Afia eventually resurfaced in Afghanistan, and, you know, a lot of talk about what happened after she was taken into custody by Afghan police in Afghanistan, but we still, you know, don't know a lot about what happened to her in those missing 5 years. We have recovered two of the children, and I've been able to interview them, and they were, you know, horribly mistreated, and eventually we found them through different humanitarian organizations. One of them was, you know, eventually showed up back in Pakistan. The other one we had to get from Afghanistan. You know, they've been in various orphanages and safe houses in secret under different names. So Afia herself, you know, we don't know where exactly she was kept, but, you know, I've now met with her several times while she's been in prison, and she has told me some of her story. And it really is a horrific one. She's horribly abused, tortured. Her children were threatened that, you know, that if she didn't cooperate with her captors, that she would eventually be, you know, shown her daughter brought in and raped in front of her.
Oh, my gosh.
Or her children killed. And, you know, as a mother, you know, I think that that's kind of the worst torture that someone
can. Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, those were the missing 5 years, and that, unfortunately, nobody has ever been held accountable. It wasn't part of her trial in the United States, and we still, you know, we are still pressing both the United States government and the Pakistani government to come clean about their actions and what they
did. Was she held in Bagram for a while? There was some speculation about that.
Well, a lot of people thought that that might have been one of the places where she was held. Yvonne Ridley, an activist who did a great deal of work in campaigning on Afia's case, you know, she had evidence that she had collected about Afia being at Bagram. Whether or not she was at Bagram, you know, is a fact that the U.S. government probably will never confirm to us, but... You know, but we do know that she was definitely in custody for 5 years, imprisoned and abused. And whether it was at Bagram or other facilities isn't entirely clear, but I know for a fact that she was moved to many different facilities, and a lot of them weren't prisons. I mean, the way that this happens is people are taken to houses and sort of illegal detention places where... you know, it's not a formal prison because they're being held off the books. They're sort of secret, clandestine places where if you want to disappear somebody into thin air, you would take them not to an established prison or a military base, but to, you know, a house where you might have people, you know, in charge of imprisoning them kind of off the books.
So talk about her arrest and what happened when she was in custody in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, what's so interesting is that, you know, after 5 years of, you know, essentially being thought and presumed dead by her family and everyone else, she resurfaces after journalists sort of start saying that they had evidence, like Yvonne Ridley, like I mentioned, who talked about her being at Bagram, had a big press conference and said, you know, we have evidence that this person was held illegally in U.S. custody. And all of a sudden, Afia Siddiqui reappears in Afghanistan. And what we know from her now is how she got there was she's essentially drugged and put on a bus, and you know, when she kind of came to, she was there with a little bag that had been given to her and a boy who, you know, she was told was her son, and they were found wandering around in Afghanistan, and I think her captors had essentially planned to have her framed for as being a suicide bomber, because that had been the cover story for a long time about you know, from the FBI putting her on lists and claiming that she was a dangerous person. And I think, you know, her captors had, under, you know, threats of torture, had had her copy down incriminating statements and all sorts of, you know, plans that she was a suicide bomber and all of these things, and put it in a little bag of goodies and sent her off. And I think the plan was for her to be, you know, shot or arrested and locked up based on what she had on her possession at the time when she resurfaced in Afghanistan. But instead what happened is Afia went to the mosque. She didn't go to the place where, you know, she was supposed to have been captured. She wandered off to the mosque, and some Afghans came and said, you know, what is this woman doing here alone by herself with this little boy? And they called the Afghan police to come and take her in, more as a protective measure for her as a stranger who didn't speak their language than they did really as, you know, as somebody who is threatening in any way. But she's taken into Afghan custody, and the Afghans find this bag of goodies and decide that they're going to call the American authorities, and American authorities come to the Afghan police station, and essentially their version of the story of these individuals who came is that they did not know Afia Siddiqui was in the room when they entered a 300-square-foot room and, you know, sort of relaxedly put down their weapons, and that she lunged, got one of the weapons, and opened fire on them, and they shot her in self-defense. Now, of course, the forensic evidence that came out at trial, she was eventually, you know, she was shot and almost killed in that incident.
Uh-huh.
She was taken to, at that point, we know she was taken to Bagram Air Base when she was in the hospital. And before her wounds had even recovered, they had sent her back to the United States illegally to stand trial in the United States. I mean, you know, she's a Pakistani citizen. She was in Afghanistan. Why the United States government decided to take her to the United States and put her on trial, you know, it's not consistent with international law. She should have been given access to the Pakistani consular officials, and she should have been either tried in Afghanistan if there was evidence, or, you know, not sent to the United States for trial. But in any event, that's what U.S. authorities decided to do. And in this trial, you know, it's very, very interesting. I mean, there's not a shred of physical evidence that came out at this trial that Dr. Siddiqui actually picked up a gun, much less, you know, touched it, or, you know, there's no fingerprints on this gun. The only evidence of bullets being shot in this room are the bullets that were fired by the U.S. soldiers, which shot Afia twice.
Uh-huh.
The forensic evidence shows that they shot her twice. There's no forensic evidence that she in any way, you know, threatened them first. And in fact, the Afghan authorities that were present at the scene told an entirely different story. And, you know, despite this, she was convicted in New York in trial and sentenced to 86 years in prison, which was a bit outrageous considering that it was the only person injured in this alleged incident was Afia herself, and she almost died from the bullets that she took when she was shot by the U.S. soldiers. So
uh-huh.
She was, you know, she suffered greatly. She's still suffering. She's now imprisoned in Texas on a military base inside of a federal prison in a unit where she really doesn't have any contact with the outside world. Her mental and physical health continues to deteriorate. She's extremely traumatized by the treatment she received when she was tortured for 5 years in prison. And, you know, she still doesn't have access to her family, really. Her children that we've recovered, their ordeal live in Pakistan, as does her mother and her sister. And she doesn't really have any way of communicating with them. So, you know, it's really, she continues to suffer now, and we still
uh-huh.
don't have anybody standing up to say, you know, what was done to her was wrong and to come clean about it.
Well, I was in New York on the, I believe it was the first day of her trial,
And she had been before the judge before, and sorry, excuse me. I've been riding my bike. I'm on this tour de Tis, and we've been riding, and we're down California, and so all the dust and everything's kind of getting in my throat. But she was also complaining about her treatment while she was being detained, and it seemed to me to be very, unnecessary. I've been in jail a lot, but I've never been in prison for long term. And, you know, I know how people get treated, but it seemed like her treatment was unnecessarily harsh, and it didn't seem like the judge was interested in making sure that, you know, the trial was transparent, that her treatment was humane, and that she got a fair trial.
No, I mean, there's, you know, she didn't get a fair trial. And unfortunately, I mean, every way you look at it, she didn't get a fair trial. I mean, first of all, you know, she was still recovering from gunshot wounds. And some of the evidence that the FBI claimed that she made statements that were incriminating during a time when she had been strapped, you know, her arms and legs strapped to four points of the bed while she was still recovering and on morphine and all sorts of drugs. They claim she made statements to them that were incriminating and, you know, confessed to things, which, you know, I don't know if any of us in the hospital in that sort of situation would be able to confirm or deny what we said under such circumstances.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, that was, you know, that's sort of the start of it. But even when she got to the United States, you know, in order to even attend the court proceedings or even to meet with any attorney, she was subjected to very brutal strip searches, which were not just, you know, take off your clothes, but, I mean, she is a devout Muslim, and she's from a part of the world where it would be absolutely unheard of to make prisoners strip down in front of members of the opposite sex. And in fact, at Carswell, you know, there was a team of men who essentially held her down and forcibly, you know, stripped her clothes and humiliated her while, you know, she was in custody. So she was really not wanting to participate in the legal process if it meant that she essentially had to be tortured in order to get there. So that was one, you know, just one of the many ways in which I feel like, you know, her participation in the legal process was really, you know, was interfered with. The other way is that she was never allowed to hire attorneys of her own choice. The judge allowed attorneys that had been appointed by the U.S. government, you know, they were sort of the equivalent of like public defenders who, but, you know, they were being paid by the U.S. government, and Afia wanted to retain her own counsel. But on top of that, in addition to that, he also forced her to keep three attorneys on her case who were paid by the Pakistani government in addition. And those attorneys were paid $2 million by the government of Pakistan to represent Afia. And no investigation into the government of Pakistan's role in her original abduction or any investigation into what happened during those missing 5 years was done by any of these attorneys. She also was not allowed to talk about the 5 years that she was missing and tortured as part of this trial. It was only about what happened in a 300-square-foot room. And at the end, it was her word again, and all of the forensic evidence against the word of some U.S. soldiers. And, and that's how it went. So it's really, you know, it really was not, you know, I attended every day of that trial as counsel to the family. At that point, she was not able to really communicate with anyone other than the court-appointed lawyers. So she wasn't able to, you know, I wouldn't have been able to meet with her. And it was not until after the appeal had been filed by the lawyers that she, in fact, tried to fire many, many times, and who stayed on the case despite the fact that she didn't want them, it wasn't until after all of that had happened that I was actually able to gain access to her, and when she actually retained me. So, you know, for all of those years during her legal proceedings, she never had an attorney of her choice that she trusted, and she was not a participant in her defense.
Well, yes, I remember that we, you know, I remember her saying when I was at the trial, the beginning of her trial, that, you know, these weren't her attorneys, you know, and I'm just really glad that she stood up for her rights, you know, her human rights, her civil rights, and didn't let, you know, anybody. They can push you around physically, but she didn't let anybody steal her dignity from her, and I really admired her for that.
Yeah, I think she, you know, I agree with you. She's really an inspiration, and when I meet with her, you know, I think, my gosh, you know, the fact that this woman is even alive is really something.
Uh-huh.
I think it is a testament to her. And, you know, her strength of what she's been able to survive. She's still tormented from the things that have happened to her. But she's, despite all of that, you know, she's always maintained that, you know, she doesn't want any violence done in her name. She forgave the judge after, you know, all of the things that had been done to her.
Uh-huh.
She encouraged everybody else to forgive him for, you know, what she felt was a miscarriage of justice. But she's a very compassionate person and somebody who is very principled, and who, when I go and meet with her, you know, she expresses compassion and is worried about me, which is very touching considering the
uh-huh.
fact that, you know,
uh-huh.
she herself has just suffered so greatly and continues to suffer every day. So she's the one that gives me strength to continue this fight, and I think, you know, I'm not surprised that she touched you on the time when you were able to see her, and she's touched a lot of people. And I think her case is obviously so extreme and such a horrible abuse that in Pakistan, I mean, you can't really walk the streets without anybody not knowing who Afia Siddiqui is. Her name is everywhere. Her picture is everywhere. Everybody knows who Afia Siddiqui is. And she's come to symbolize the brutality and the miscarriage of justice that a lot of people have experienced. And I think, you know, I hope that, you know, folks like you and other activists here in the United States will continue to discuss the case and raise awareness about her plight, because it's ongoing. She is imprisoned here in the United States, and there are things that we can do to help.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what we could do to help.
Well, I think people should definitely visit freeafia.org, which is the website that her family maintains that has all of the listings of the various organizations and groups of people and individuals who have, you know, have taken action to try to free Afia. And there are all sorts of activities which, you know, are ongoing. There have been protests outside of the prison. There are letter writing campaigns. There are, you know, places where you can contribute financially. There's, you know, I think the most important thing is, you know, to just keep her case alive and in the public eye, because, the one thing that you know, the U.S. government and the Pakistani government do not want is for Afia Siddiqui's story to continue to burn in the minds of the public. Right now there are elections in Pakistan, and it's become a hot election issue. And here in the United States, there are people who should be held accountable for their
uh-huh.
role and what they did in Afia's case. And as long as we can continue to pressure both governments and to keep to raise awareness amongst more people and make the case more of a mainstream issue that people are aware of, the more I think that we can prevent this kind of thing from happening to other people in the future, because to let this kind of gross human rights and civil rights abuse continue to to go on is just basically a green light for this to happen to you and me and anybody else when, you know, we could be next.
Well, we are running out of time. I do want you to repeat the website again, but why do you think is the motivation for the U.S. to do this to Dr. Siddiqui?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily that anyone went out to put an innocent person in prison, but I think such horrible mistakes were made after 9/11 and abuses were committed as part of the so-called war on terror that it's so embarrassing at this point to admit. And, you know, the things that were done to her were criminal. So I think, you know, that's a large part of the motivation why this injustice continues. And again, people should visit freeafia.org to get all of the information about Afia. And I encourage people to really look at the facts of this case, because there is a lot of rhetoric and there are a lot of false facts that have been floated out there by various groups. But that's the website, freeafia.org, that people can get accurate information that has actually been vetted through the family about who Afia is and what the facts of her trial and her case, what has come to light. So that's where I would encourage people to look.
Well, Tina Foster, next time you talk to her, please give her my love and support, and know that we do try to keep the case alive at Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and also, other political prisoners. It seems like we focus a lot on political prisoners, and it's just, the U.S. wants to set itself up as a model of justice and democracy around the world, but the instances of injustice and miscarriages of justice and just abominations of justice are just so frequent that we really can't give up the fight, the struggle, that's for sure.
Well, thank you so much for what you're doing, and I definitely will tell Afia the next time I see her, that about you and about, the fact that all of you are keeping her name alive and continuing to shed light on this issue. So I really appreciate it.
Okay, Tina Foster, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and for the work that you're doing to help Dr. Siddiqui.
Thank you.
Okay, well, keep up the struggle.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was our guest, Tina Foster. Well, like I said, go to tourtopeace.org, get more information about our tour. And like I said before, we're having a fabulous time and connecting with so many wonderful people. So I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer, Don DeBar, and he's also our contact with Community Progressive Radio, my producer, Mikey. I'd like to thank my guest, Tina Foster, and you, especially for listening and supporting the show. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.